Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 2,500 business and political leaders, including 80 billionaires, attended the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland this week. Tickets cost between $30,000 and $40,000 to attend, and corporate sponsors include Nestle, Shell, Walmart, and Goldman Sachs. According to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, the wealthiest people on the planet, many of them in Davos, added $524 billion to their collective net worth last year. And according to a report by the World Economic Forum, which sponsors the conference in Davos, the widening gap between the richest and poorest citizens, quote, threatens social and political stability as well as economic development. And then there's a new report from Oxfam, and that found that the 85 richest humans hold more wealth than the 3.5 billion people who constitute the bottom half. Today's guest, David K. Johnston, says most of our nationally prominent journalists do not know that the rich are getting richer while the vast majority is getting poorer because they, quote, neglect to do a basic journalistic task. It's called reporting. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and a best-selling author. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Rose.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Michael Hudson, senior editor at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Michael was involved with a multinational team of journalists who spent 6 months combing through secret tax haven records, revealing offshore holdings of the wealthy in China. According to the consortium, it's the first time that such a large amount of secret information about Chinese dealings in tax havens have been made public, and this story has been censored in mainland China. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Hi, David.
And we are joined by Paul Blumenthal. Paul covers campaign finance for the Huffington Post, and this week he's been reporting on the fourth anniversary of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, which allows corporations, unions, and individual donors to spend unlimited sums of money on political campaigns. Paul reports that the top 1% of Super PAC donors reads like a guest list at Davos. This four-year anniversary has received quite a bit of attention in the independent media, but not so much in the national media. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to reporters who did a good job this week. So, David, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there was a wonderful story by Stephanie Strom in the New York Times about the movement to stop raising pigs in these inhumane crates so they can't move around.
Oh.
And put them out in fields. And it included a picture of a bunch of pigs in the snow at a farm in upstate New York. Now, there's a second part to this little story. When the Malaysian printer of the international edition of the New York Times published the story, they put blackout squares, you know, like places that don't want to run nude pictures of people do on strategic parts of the body. They put blackout squares on the faces of the pigs lest they offend Muslims in Malaysia. I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound disrespectful to anybody's religious views. I don't think this is about religious views. This is about really dumb editors. But it's cute, and it draws attention to how we need to think about cultural differences.
Oh, that's strange. Well, at first I thought you were going to say that they had a different photo on the international edition, because Time magazine often does that.
Yes, well, they did use a different picture of pigs than the one that was prominently featured, at least in the print edition of the New York Times that I get in Rochester, New York, which is, you know, they print in various places around the country.
Yeah.
But in the international edition, it was a picture apparently supplied by the Times, but with the faces of the pigs blacked out, because we certainly wouldn't want to look at the faces of pigs.
Especially pigs that are about to be slaughtered. So this is a story about demand for pigs that are raised humanely, or demand grows for pigs that are raised humanely
outdoors.
Well,
and part of the overall discussion about how the industrial food business treats America. You know, every year a president of the United States pardons a turkey.
Right.
It's always one of those big industrial turkeys. It's not the heritage turkeys, many of which are grown and promoted by people in, by the way, the listening area of your station.
Well, thank you for that. We will put a link to this right after our show. Thanks for that, David. And let's go to you, Paul. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, before I came on, I didn't realize that Michael was going to be on, and I was going to mention his report from ICIJ on the new China leaks. you know, the work that the ICIJ has been doing around these offshore leaks about offshore holdings of the wealthiest people around the world is just really amazing investigative work, and I'm just always impressed by it. And, I mean, I think I'll let him talk about it in this hour, and happy to hear from him.
Yeah, it's a huge report. I mean, they've done work on offshore tax havens around the globe, and this one specifically focused on China. And we will be talking about that shortly. So, Michael, you just got kudos from our guest today, Paul.
Yeah, thanks so much, Paul. I appreciate it. It was a work of a lot of folks at ICIJ and in other our partners around the world, especially folks in Hong Kong and mainland China and Taiwan, who are really, you know, putting themselves at risk doing this kind of work. It's easy, you know, American journalists, with a few exceptions, such as war correspondents, we're generally pretty safe. We have it relatively easy compared to journalists around the world who are really in danger for doing a very simple thing, which is, you know, reporting the facts.
And we'll be talking about that in just a couple minutes. But before we do, what did you see this week that you thought was done well, Michael?
Well, I wanted to give some kudos to Roddy Boyd. He runs something called the Southern Investigative Reporting Project. It's a small nonprofit. There are lots of, you know, nonprofit journalism outfits that are popping up now as a legacy media struggle. And he had some great reporting about a Ponzi scheme that attempted to an alleged Ponzi scheme that happened through a hedge fund that attempted to capitalize on the mortgage crisis, and New York prosecutors have just charged the principal in that, so he's gotten some results.
And will he serve time, or will he be fined?
Well, the case has to play out now. So, but you know, Roddy's reporting, you know, really sort of laid the groundwork for the authorities to come in and actually do something.
And Michael, you cover this stuff really closely. I've been reading the New York Times a lot lately, and it seems like there have been a lot more prosecutions coming down on various people involved with mortgages or stocks. It just seems like there's been a lot more lately.
There have been, but I will hasten to add that most of the people who are being prosecuted are sort of mid-level, but often sort of low-level stuff, especially in the mortgage space you're talking about. They're prosecuting loan officers and folks like that, not people at the top who were either involved or knew or should have known what was going on. You know, one of the most interesting things about sort of the mortgage disaster is the number of employees within, you know, the home loan machine that raise questions, you know, fraud, you know, because these lenders have fraud investigators, risk managers, and again these folks pointed out the fraud, said, you know, these loans are fraudulent, you know, this branch or this region is engaged in faking borrowers' incomes, lying to borrowers, forging people's signatures on documents. And the response from above almost uniformly was not to act on the reports, but rather to harass or punish, fire, demote, marginalize the whistleblowers, the internal gatekeepers who were doing their jobs.
Hmm. All right. Well, we will also link to that. David,
Michael wrote a book that did an excellent job of laying out particularly what happened at Countrywide. I think a prosecutor and a president of the United States who's attorney general was actually interested in white-collar law enforcement instead of what he's running, which is protection for white-collar criminals, could easily have made a case that Countrywide was a criminal enterprise. And the number of prosecutions here is minute, even with all the minor fish who are being gone after. Remember that Attorney General Holder testified to the U.S. Senate that he is afraid to prosecute the biggest banks in this country because he thinks it would damage the economy. And I've had two pieces I've written in Newsweek, one last month, one this month, showing that it was well known inside J.P. Morgan Bank that Bernard Madoff was for several decades running a Ponzi scheme. There were lots of badges of fraud that any small-town banker would immediately have recognized as indications of criminal activity, and yet They are all being shielded and protected by the Obama administration, which is helping foster more crimes that I am sure are going on today and will come out in the future.
Well, and, you know, that leads us right into Davos, because Davos got so much attention this week, David. And, you know, a lot of people were writing that there was an interesting kind of, not fight, but disagreement in Davos, where you had a lot of the bankers, the very people that you're talking about, were trying to tell everyone else that everything's just fine. Don't worry about the economy. We're all going to be okay. But a lot of the attendees are not really believing them. That was one kind of interesting thing that I got from some of the coverage.
Well, yes. And I wrote a piece about this for Al Jazeera, where I do a column every week, that the annual global risk assessment that is done for the World Economic Forum, the Billionaires Forum in Davos, showed that the number one risk in the world is what's happening from inequality. And I pointed out that, you know, the surprising thing is that we have not had as many riots. We haven't seen a lot of revolutions. But if, as this survey points out, and it was paid for, by the way, by three big sophisticated organizations that specialize in risk, Marsh & McLennan, which is a huge insurance operation in the U.S., and two Swiss insurance companies. They were the principal funders. And the inequality is completely remaking what's going on in our world. Oxfam wrote a report keying off this that 85 people have as much wealth as the bottom half, 3.5 billion people. And if you go on the internet, you can see a Canadian show where they interviewed somebody who's often on TV here in America who went, that's terrific. We want more of that.
There was an Onion article the last couple days, which the headline was something like, if the world's richest people each donated $1 a day to charity, that would add up to, roughly $85 a day.
Well, and diving into talking about the tax havens and the things that you've been writing about, Michael, the Oxfam report noted, quote, policies successfully imposed by the rich in recent decades include financial deregulation, tax havens and secrecy, anti-competitive business practices, lower tax rates on high incomes, and investments and cuts or underinvestment in public service for the majority. And there's also another great column over at The Guardian called Davos Debates Income Inequality But Still Invites Tax Avoiders. So what are your thoughts on how the offshore tax havens are being covered, Michael?
Well, there has been an increasing amount of coverage, and there's been some pretty good reporting. But, you know, I mean, my concern is always that it's sort of like, oh, look at these bad tax havens. The British Virgin Islands, they're bad, and the Cayman Islands, look at those bad guys. But the truth is that, you know, the world's richest nations and large Western institutions like accounting firms and big banks are all key parts of the offshore system. You know, in our reporting, our most recent reporting on China, we found that PricewaterhouseCoopers, UBS, and other Western banks and accounting firms were playing a key role as middlemen in helping wealthy Chinese clients and Chinese companies set up trust in hard-to-trace companies in the British Virgin Islands, Samoa, and other offshore centers. It's, you know, the big wealthy Western nations, Switzerland, yes, but also the United States, the UK, play a big role in how the offshore system has grown and in terms of enabling it and also being sources of the money, you know. And even the United States, people think of, you know, the United States has fought to go after Swiss banks that have been shielding U.S. taxpayers' money. But on the other hand, there's lots of money pouring in from Latin America because the United States, New York banks, Miami banks are big destinations for hard-to-trace money from from Latin America.
Well, and then there are the U.S. corporations, which Oxfam implicitly is talking about some of these companies at Davos. Microsoft, for example, transferred half of its net revenue from U.S. retail sales to a Puerto Rican subsidiary between 2009 and 2011, and that saved the company $4.5 billion in taxes. And Paul, a lot of the Davos coverage is just celebrating Bill Gates, whose fortune is about $78 million, and they're talking about his anti-poverty crusade. But why isn't the tax haven part of this part of the coverage, Paul? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that, you know, one thing that we need to address here and that I think has sort of been touched on is that a lot of these institutions, including Bill Gates and Microsoft and all of these big banks that are helping facilitate these offshore companies and transfers, are gigantic campaign donors to our politicians here in Washington and run large lobbying operations. And if you look overall in the past 30 years, the actual, as you know, income inequality has grown, so has the inequality in the political marketplace in America, where in 1980 you had about 15% of all campaign contributions came from 0.01% of all donors. Now, those same 0.01% of donors in 2012 accounted for 40% of every campaign contribution. And, you know, these are people like Bill Gates, who can give tens of thousands of dollars or even millions of dollars through a super PAC, people like the Koch brothers, people like George Soros, and, you know, lots of other of the wealthiest Americans. And a lot of this facilitates the attitude of our government to not want to prosecute these people who are big campaign donors with close relationships to top officials, to not want to investigate them in Congress, to, you know, not want to pass legislation that could damage the wealth that they are accruing and you know, the tax wealth that they're taking away from the government that could be spent on poorer and middle class people.
And that is Paul Blumenthal. He covers campaign finance for the Huffington Post. He's been reporting on the four-year anniversary of the Supreme Court Citizens United decision. It turned four this week. It got a lot of attention in the independent media, not so much in the national media. We're also joined by Michael Hudson, senior editor at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. He was involved with a multinational team of journalists who spent 6 months combing through secret tax haven records revealing offshore holdings of the wealthy in China. The story has been censored in mainland China. And David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He writes a weekly column for Al Jazeera America. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. Davos got a lot of attention this week. Inequality and these new reports are getting attention. But what do you think of the way these issues are actually being reported? We'll talk with David later on because he goes after some journalists saying that they still don't get it. They still don't understand why this income inequality is happening. So what are your thoughts on that? And then if you saw another report this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. The other thing that struck us, Michael, about your recent investigation about offshore tax havens and Chinese officials is this is often referred to in other places as corruption. But when we're talking about offshore tax havens in the United States, we don't tend to use that word. It's like corruption happens somewhere else in the media.
Yeah, we like, because often corruption in developing nations is so brazen. You know, somebody is pocketing money. There's money. There may actually even be some money in a suitcase before it gets into the bank account. But you know, we have our own corruption in the United States, and in many ways, we also serve, as I said, as a tax haven, as a secrecy haven. There are states like Delaware. You know, when you talk to people in the British Virgin Islands and other, you know, places that have been labeled as tax havens, one of the first things they say is, what about Delaware? It's easier to set up a secret company in Delaware than it is in the British Virgin Islands. In the British Virgin Islands, we will at least make you, we may not make it the information public, but we will at least make you, you know, give us names, give us some background. In Delaware, it's pretty much just, you know, you can start a company very quickly, very easily, very cheaply, without providing any information as to who's really behind the company.
What really struck you about what you uncovered about China? Because you report that China's elites were aggressively using offshore havens to hold assets, list companies in the world's stock exchanges, buy and sell real estate, and conduct their business away from Beijing's red tape and capital controls.
Right. Well, part of it is sort of just a logistical thing of trying to do business around the world, and you know, you can't say that every company or every individual who is using an offshore center to do a transaction is involved in some sort of corruption. But what you can say is that almost all the grand corruption cases, the major Ponzi schemes, looting of government treasuries, public officials taking bribes, that's going to have an offshore element.
And also, you partnered with the Guardian and Spain's El País, a number of other publications. What kind of attention is this getting? Because we noticed that the attention that China is getting in Davos is focusing on the tension between China and Japan.
Right. It's been, you know, we've been getting a lot of attention around the world, a lot of world media, a lot of folks are talking about it on Twitter. Of course, it's hard for people in China to get the information about what's happening because the censors have blocked our stories. They blocked the Guardian stories. They blocked El País's stories. There's an information deficit there. I mean, folks are trying to figure out ways to get the story into China now.
Also, a reporter who was working on this piece from Beijing had to pull out immediately because reporters had been warned by Chinese government officials to discontinue their work.
Yes, we had, and I can't say who the partner was, but we had a news organization in the mainland that we were partnering with, and they got a message from the government: you need to back off this story. And they did. We have partners in Hong Kong and Taiwan who continued working on the story and have done some great work.
And David, in our we have about a minute before we go to break, but you've written extensively about offshore tax havens. There have been books about it. Do these reports result in any changes?
Oh, we've had some relatively minor cosmetic changes that have gone on. But, you know, we make a harder effort in the United States to identify poor children or children who are not eligible for subsidized lunches. All school lunches are subsidized, but there's three tiers. And children in the bottom two tiers, we make a greater effort to identify children who are not entitled to a larger subsidy for their school lunch than we do the illicit transfer of money to tax havens. And Michael Hudson is exactly right. The people in other countries will point to us and say, not just in Delaware, in Wyoming, in Nevada, the rules are incredibly loose. The former Panamanian ambassador to the U.S. has said publicly after 9/11 and got almost no coverage of it that if you were a terrorist who wanted to engage in the U.S., the easiest way to do it was to set up a Nevada corporation and funnel the money through it, and no one would know what happens. And in fact, someone took out the name Internal Revenue Service as a business in Nevada and then used that as proof that it was with a Puerto Rico address, that the IRS is really a private enterprise. It's not a government agency. I mean, only loony people would believe such things. But our rules at the state and local level on things like this are incredibly lax. They are an enormous gift to con artists. They are a risk to us from people engaged in criminal or similar actions.
And hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We're talking about offshore tax havens. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
All of the stories you hear recommended and featured on the Friday Media Roundtable will be posted at yourcallradio.org. We invite you to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable, that is, by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. You can also send email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC, Today News from Geneva, that the Syrian government delegation has threatened to quit peace talks. As well, the latest from the streets of Kiev, where protesters have been erecting new barricades. Meanwhile, the state of emergency continues in Bangkok. That's all coming up in 30 minutes on World Have Your Say from the BBC here on Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation about the struggle for transgender civil rights and equality. There's a new bill in California, Assembly Bill 1266, which went into effect on January 1st, prohibits public schools from discriminating on the basis of gender identity and gender expression. So we'll talk about how this law is making a difference. We'll also talk more broadly about the challenges transgender people face. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also join us. Today, we are talking about income inequality, the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, offshore tax havens, and then we'll dive a little deeper into the Citizens United four-year anniversary, and we'll talk about how that's drastically changed politics and how the media are or are not covering that. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, and if you saw a story this week that you'd like to talk about, you can call us or send us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He writes a weekly column for Al Jazeera America. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Paul Blumenthal covers campaign finance for The Huffington Post. He's been reporting on Citizens United. And Michael Hudson is senior editor at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. He and a multinational team of journalists spent 6 months combing through secret tax haven records, revealing offshore holdings of the wealthy in China. The story has been censored in mainland China. And Michael, before we let you go, you all have done so much reporting on offshore tax havens. You heard David just talk about the fact that it doesn't really get the coverage it deserves. But why do you think that? And then also, as a result of your former reports, there have been some investigations around the world. Has anything concrete come out of your reporting in terms of changes?
In terms of changes, you know, there has been, you know, and you have to look at the background, is that we have these sort of moments in time, waves of interest, where the big economic powers, the U.S. and Germany and the U.K., promise big things. We're going to end banking secrecy. We're going to end tax havens. You know what? This happened in the early 2000s. It happened again in 2009, and each time that. You know, very little comes about. So we're in another moment now, partly because of our stories, partly because of people's concerns about economic inequality, more promise has been made and actually more action has been taken in terms of the countries around the world agreeing to swap tax information so that you can track down tax dodgers. But whether or not that really turns into real change remains to be seen. There's a battle going on. There certainly have been a lot of sort of one-off reactions to us. People in, you know, raids of the by South Korean prosecutors of that country's former president's home. The deputy speaker of the Mongolian parliament was forced to resign after we revealed that he had $1 million in a Swiss account. We've had lots of resignations, lots of efficient investigations launched. But you know, the key with this is there needs to be sort of continuing pressure. You know, media investigative reporting tends to do the sort of big boffo thing. It comes out, it has a multi-part series, and then the media go on to something else. And you know, our goal is to continue to report on this and continue to cast an eye and keep the pressure on so that this issue doesn't die down again. Mm-hmm. And I will say that in terms of European media and media around the world, there has been a lot of attention, a lot of sustained attention over the last year. But American media, it's been a little bit here and there. There have been some good stories, but it hasn't been the sort of sustained outrage, the sort of sustained coverage that you see in other parts of the world.
What explains that?
I'm not really sure. I think part of, and maybe David would have some thoughts on this. I think part of it is that, you know, the sort of free market ethos of the United States means that a lot of folks say, oh, well, you know, people should hide their money from the government. The taxes are too high. We need to, you know, people should have the right to move their money wherever they want. It's nobody's business if I have $1 million in an account in the Cook Islands. I don't think everybody in America feels like that, but I think enough sort of people, enough, you know, bloggers and columnists and people like that have that kind of point of view. That in the United States, the coverage of this, there has been quite a bit, but it's been, you know, a fraction of what we've seen in Europe.
Paul, what are your thoughts about that? Do you agree with Michael? Is that why we're not seeing much coverage of this in the United States?
I mean, I think that largely makes sense. I think that there's just, a lot of the coverage that we see comes through cable news or large newspapers, and oftentimes they sort of jump from one thing to the other, and I mean the focus on this requires a lot of sustained attention, and that just I find is increasingly growing absent in our media, whether it's through cable news or online social media on Twitter. You know, people jump from one thing to the next pretty quickly.
And it ties in with Citizens United, because while the four-year anniversary got attention in the independent media, other than McClatchy and Politico and MSNBC, which all ran op-eds, it didn't get that much attention in the national media. And the op-ed writers said that, you know, this has radically changed our politics. Ron Fein, who is the legal director for Free Speech for People, writing over at McClatchy, said he doesn't think the public realizes just how drastic Citizens United has changed politics and how it's just giving corporations a lot more power. So why do you think this didn't get as much attention this week?
I mean, I think, you know, in the political journalism world, there's a lot of cynicism around campaign finance and campaign finance reform, you know, I feel like there's sometimes a sense that, oh, you know, we've covered Citizens United for 3 years, fourth year anniversary. It's just kind of old news at this point. It sort of sets in that this is the norm, especially considering a lot of campaign finance coverage in the United States revolves around just sort of who's up and who's down, which is not always the best way to cover this. You know, which super PAC raised the most money, which candidate raised the most money, who's winning the money race, is sort of how a lot of this coverage occurs. I think that there's also a sense of a desire to be counterintuitive about campaign finance and reform efforts to say that, you know, maybe it's, you know, it's not Citizens United that's doing this, it's something else. It's the passage of McCain-Feingold driving money away from the parties, which the New York Times had an article saying as much a year or two ago. And so I think that there's a lot of that sense in the political media that, you know, a desire to see this differently, and also just sort of a feeling that it's starting to become old news. This is just how politics is.
Well, and we'll talk in a few minutes about the seven charts that you looked at to help understand how Citizens United has drastically changed politics. But before we do that, David, we have to let Michael go in a minute. What did you think of his assessment about why an issue like tax havens isn't getting as much attention in the United States versus other parts of the world? David? Did we lose David?
Hello.
Oh, there you are. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry, my mute button must have been kicked down by mistake.
Sure.
In the United States, unfortunately, we have newspapers and big foundations that operate in the same model. You know, this is the disease of the year or the story of the week. And sustained coverage is not seen as a smart model, even though that's how advertising is sold. If you come to a big newspaper or television and say, I want to spend all my money in one day, they'll say, no. You want to have something on again and again and again and again and again to get that idea embedded in the public mind. And newspapers just don't follow that model, and nor do the big TV stations, nor do the networks.
And Michael, before we let you go, what are you working on right now? I'm sure you're trying to get this investigative piece about China out there.
Yes, we have more stories to come, and I can't talk too much about them. But you know, what we've done is a lot of stories naming names, attaching public officials, public figures to offshore entities, and we've also done a lot of stories really trying to explain why this happens and getting at the context. But we're gonna be doing some more investigative stories looking at who are the enablers, who are the operatives behind the offshore system, who are the professionals, the accountants, the bankers, and folks like that who make it go, who make it work.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your reporting.
Thanks, Rose, and thanks, Paul. Thanks, David. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. That is Michael Hudson. He's senior editor at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. They spent 6 months combing through secret tax haven records revealing offshore holdings of the wealthy in China. It's the first time that such a large amount of secret information about Chinese dealings in tax havens has been made public, and the story has been censored in mainland China. And you can find it at our website, yourcallradio.org. And staying with us for the rest of the hour is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He writes a weekly column for Al Jazeera America. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And Paul Blumenthal covers campaign finance for The Huffington Report. He's been reporting on the Citizens United decision. And we got an email from Henry who wanted us to talk more about the Oxfam report. And just to go over some of the highlights, almost half of the world's wealth is now owned by 1% of the population. The wealth of the 1% amounts to $110 trillion. That's 65 times the total wealth of the bottom half of the world's population. And David, you included these stats in your latest Al Jazeera America column. And then you write in your latest National Memo column, you actually criticize the New York Times' David Brooks for a column he wrote on inequality. He's actually getting a lot of criticism for that. You say that journalists don't know that the rich are getting richer because journalists, quote, neglect to do a basic journalistic task. It's called reporting. Why did you decide to zero in on David Brooks this time around?
Well, David Brooks's column was so incredibly ill-informed. For starters, he described the plutocrat class basically as the top 5%. I'm sorry, the top 5% starts at not much north of $100,000 a year. The plutocrat class starts at around $9 million a year, and those are the people who have to report their income for tax purposes. You know, the very super wealthiest people don't have to report their incomes legally, or at least the money they spend legally, because they borrow against their assets. And I just showed with the numbers that his column was nonsense. The New York Times ran 1,092 comments, which I read every one, and they were overwhelmingly critical of him before they finally said enough and cut it off. And Brooks has a long, long history of being wrong, of not knowing what he's writing about. Other people have routinely taken him apart. And I just finally said enough. This is just absurd when the material is there. And the problem is that Brooks is one of these guys, and Washington is full of them, who go to cocktail parties and get invited to people's homes who are prominent, and they think that makes them important instead of actually getting out and reporting. And then they figure out a way to write things in a way that won't offend their patrons and sources.
Well, and a guy like David Brooks has such a huge microphone. In addition to the New York Times column, he's on NPR every Friday, and then he's on the NewsHour on PBS every Friday.
Yes.
Talking about these issues.
That's right. And if you watch, you know, carefully, you will notice that the critical material about what's going on that's factually based, that's Bill Moyers, has been shunted off to the side, and it appears at hours when there's a very small audience. This is part of this appealing to the donors who support public radio and television, and it's a real fundamental problem that is distorting our knowledge of things. But there's no excuse for the New York Times to run the journalistic garbage, and that's what it is, that David Brooks routinely writes, and in this case, it just stunk to high heaven.
Mm. Well, when you have reports coming out like this one from Oxfam, 7 out of 10 people live in countries where economic inequality has increased in the last 30 years. We're now seeing reports about this being a global issue when you look at the divide between the rich and everyone else. And then you've got a conference like Davos where a lot of these people are attending, and as Paul, you write, that the top 1% of super PAC donors reads like a guest list at Davos. David, I mean, if you were there, what kind of story would you write?
Well, I don't go to things like that, and perhaps that's a valid criticism of me, but I would certainly focus on the disconnect between what the courtier class, you know, the bankers and the people selling financial services and ways to hide your money and to understate to the government your real profits and income, are doing to appeal to this crowd. Now, at least the World Economic Forum was created by a guy who was trying to get some better, deeper thought about these things. But so much of the coverage that we see, especially the television coverage, is, look how wealthy these people are, and not paying attention to the fact that, you know, we have an economy in the U.S. now where the average income of the bottom 90% of taxpayers has fallen to slightly below where it was in 1966. I was in high school down in Santa Cruz in 1966.
Well, and it is getting more attention, though. I mean, you even have Republicans now talking about poverty.
Yes, and a majority of Republicans, by the way, in the most recent polls, support higher taxes on the highest income Americans. A very large majority of Americans basically support progressive tax policies. You would have no idea that if you watched the Washington Beltway coverage, though. And it's frankly, I've made it a point all throughout my life to cover Washington without being there. When I was at the LA Times when Reagan was elected, I proposed to the paper that I be the third White House correspondent, and the rule was I couldn't leave the White House. And the national editor of the paper looked at me and said, that's an absolutely brilliant idea, and there is no chance in hell that I would ever do that. Later, Charles Savage did exactly what I had thought to do, cover the paperwork for the Boston Globe, and won the Pulitzer Prize for it.
Paul, how do you all go about covering these issues at the Huffington Post, specifically the widening gap? Because it just seems like every couple weeks a new report comes out that focuses on these issues. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the people in Davos couldn't ignore it. They're now talking about inequality also.
Yeah, I mean, you know, here, you know, we actually have devoted reporters to covering this. We have a reporter, Arthur Delaney, who specifically covers sort of the plight of, you know, poor people in America, people, you know, covering unemployment benefits being cut and what's happening to these people. We have a, you know, devoted labor reporter, Dave Jamieson, who covers what's going on at all these companies and how the, you know, workers are being hurt by changes that these companies are doing, and also reporting on, you know, these new movements by people like the McDonald's workers who've been striking and other workers, you know, seeking, you know, higher pay, better benefits, since a lot of these, you know, huge, gigantic multinational companies are telling them to accept, you know, the minimum wage and then get Medicaid and, you know, find out ways to get food stamps, you know, as Walmart does. So, I mean, we have a pretty devoted, devoted coverage to inequality. And I think that that's, you know, one of the good things about the Huffington Post is that we really don't avoid looking at, you know, what's actually going on in ordinary America.
And then you can tie that to Citizens United because, as you report, a lot of the corporations that are fighting for these policies, whether it's to oppose, you know, a raise in the minimum wage or unions or whatever, a lot of these corporations are the ones that are spending the most amount of money, thanks to Citizens United, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly their CEOs more than anything that's spending these money, at least that we know of. Citizens United also sparked a huge growth in undisclosed money being spent in politics, which could be coming from corporations that, you know, might have PR problems if they're seen to be trying to influence policy and influence our elected officials. But a lot of this is coming from CEOs. And, you know, what's really interesting is how these CEOs have been engaging and how these billionaires have been engaging. And in a lot of ways, they've been sort of creating their own networks of political organization, as you see with the Koch brothers, who, with their network of donors, put $400 million into the 2012 election, which equals the amount spent by the Republican National Committee, the main organ of the Republican Party. So here you have this sort of independent, private political organization run by billionaires that's rivaling political parties, much in the ways we're seeing around the world as, you know, corporations are now, you know, larger than entire nation states, have larger GDPs. You see, you know, the Bill Gates Foundation spends as much money as the World Health Organization on health efforts around the world. So I think that we're really seeing, you know, as billionaires get richer and richer, they have more money to invest in influencing policy around the world.
A Huffington Post analysis of reports and info from the FCC also found that dark money flowed freely in 2013. You wrote a piece called Dark Money Groups Have Already Spent Way More Than You Think, over $27 million on campaigns and issue advocacy targeting specific candidates. Do you think that we're just going to see these dollars grow and grow in the coming years? Will we just keep breaking records?
I think to a certain degree, we will keep breaking records. I think, you know, based on the way our electoral system works for the presidency, we might be reaching near a sort of top level of the amount of money that you could spend on that. $2.3 billion was spent on the presidential election, at least it was disclosed, presidential election in 2012, the general election. A little bit more was spent, including the primaries. And, you know, if you looked at the television advertising in the swing states and the really the, like, swing advertising markets, that there was no other advertising aside from these political advertisements for the presidential election. It was hard to get in if you were running for city council, if you were running even for Congress. It's hard to get your ad on the air because the you know, airwaves were completely saturated because of super PACs and because of these dark money nonprofit groups, and also just the unleashing of the presidential candidates from the public financing system that they used to use. And so it's going to be hard to really try to push more advertising on there. I mean, you saw the Romney campaign sort of pretending like they had a chance in Pennsylvania, mainly to sort of justify that they had nowhere else to spend their money. They couldn't buy ads in Ohio anymore.
David, what do you make of this? I mean, the charts are pretty amazing. Presidential TV advertising surged post-Citizens United. Top 1% of donors accounted for two-thirds of all super PAC funds in 2012. Donors choose dark money over disclosure.
Well, you know, with apologies to Will Rogers, the plutocrats have the best Congress money can buy. If you're a member of Congress, the reality is that ordinary people don't matter to you. They won't get you elected to office. They're inconsequential, and that's a terrible statement about our democracy. And I don't see any solution to it except public financing, which right now looks like it has zero chance, especially given our Supreme Court's position, totally contrary to that of the founders, by the way, that speech is money. And but on the other hand, you can't hide forever what's happening in America in terms of inequality and the damage it's doing. There are plenty of employers who are aware of the damage it's doing and the pressures that they're under. And there are a couple of simple things we could do that would stop a lot of this. One of them is to, as all of our economic competitors have in the modern world, have unions. You know, in Germany, executives have unions. That's number one. Two, stop these quote-unquote free trade deals that are not at all free trade. They are the very antithesis of free trade and are costing us lots of jobs and capital. And thirdly, have universal single-payer health care, or even if it isn't single-payer, have universal health care that is not tied to your job. Get the burden of health care off the backs of small businesses, and you'll see a much more productive economy.
And at this point, I mean, we've done some shows about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but that's another trade deal, the NAFTA on steroids, according to Public Citizen.
Right.
That's not really getting much attention.
It's, you know, there are a handful of us who've been writing about this, and, you know, one indication of this that should really trouble people, one chapter has leaked out through WikiLeaks. It's chapter QQ, which tells you there's well north of 40 chapters. That chapter is 30,000 words long. This is a very complex set of rules that are designed to protect the interests of certain people against others. And why are we doing all this in secret? Why in the world is it? Why do we want to have a fast track where Congress will hold, you know, virtually nothing but show hearings and then vote it up or down? If we're going to have a major policy change, we don't trust the people. That's what the people who are financing these elections, the people Paul is talking about, they don't want to have a public debate of these things, because if we did, it would come out how these are simply vehicles to redistribute from the many to the already rich few.
Well, you know, when you write about these issues, David, I mean, we talk about them on a regular basis. What kind of response do you get from readers?
Well, a lot of it is entirely just resupporting of what people believe. And many of the people who post at the, you know, at Newsweek, where I write about these issues, Al Jazeera, and even Tax Notes, which is, you know, an expensive non-advertising publication bought mostly by lawyers, accountants, and government officials, an enormous number of the responses that are snarky are ideological, and they ignore facts or they dismiss facts. And that's perhaps part of human nature, but it's very troubling. I mean, the whole idea of a democratic government where the people are the government requires rationality and it requires debate. And, you know, as Paul Krugman loves to point out, if the if tomorrow one of the two political parties adopted in its platform that the world is flat, the New York Times headline would be, "Parties differ on shape of planet," as opposed to, "Those people are crazy."
And they should be laughed off the stage.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. David,
I'm not surprised if people disagree, but, you know, disagree on the facts.
What are you working on right now?
Well, I have a book coming out, an anthology called Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. It'll be out in April. It has chapters from President Obama, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Stiglitz, Paul Krugman. It's about public health, incarceration, education, the entire system of inequality, because money is just the indicator that we look at, and how it was created by people and is perpetuated. In fact, I've got stuff in there from Plutarch and Adam Smith and Henry George. I have several big investigative pieces that will be coming out in Newsweek when we go back to print, which I think will be sometime in March.
Oh.
We've been doing, you know, as somebody posted recently at the internet, good grief, Newsweek, actual reporting.
And Paul, what about you? What are you working on?
Well, I'll continue to cover what's going on in campaign finance here in America around, you know, the continuation of Citizens United. There's another Supreme Court decision that's coming down the pike, the decision in McCutcheon v. FEC, which could expand the ability for the country's largest donors to give even more money.
Wow.
And so we'll see what happens there. And then, you know, I hope to also keep reporting on the inequality in the political marketplace and what that's doing in American politics.
Paul Blumenthal covers campaign finance and a number of other issues for The Huffington Post, and David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His latest book is The Fine Print. He writes a weekly column for Al Jazeera and many other publications. David and Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How far have we advanced in the struggle for transgender civil rights and equality? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about transgender rights. California Assembly Bill 1266, which went into effect on January 1st, prohibits public schools from discriminating on the basis of gender, gender identity, and gender expression. So how is this law being received, and what kind of difference is it making? And more generally, what challenges do transgender people face? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.